Okay. We're just all so excited to be back. We're talking, but it is 9 o'clock, so we do have to have a meeting also here. I'll go ahead and open the meeting, and I'll make a couple quick comments, but I think before our little bit of humor, we should take a moment of silence for Arizona. Thank you. So we'll get started by roll call, please.
Aye.
Aye. Or here?
I'm here.
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 And as I said, with the seriousness now, we could lighten it up a little bit. But, you know, with our new governor, we're very excited. And I know we have introductions. And he recently contacted a couple old-timers. And we're looking for creative ways in municipalities how to do some very environmentally friendly stormwater issues because of the cost and the budget issues that we're all dealing with. And so I did some research in Half Moon Bay, and we've done some work there. And that was only the beginning. And then what we're reading in the cell phone world, I guess, in conclusion, he asked me about the availability of carrier pigeons also. So we have a combination of things. But I appreciate Sandy and our tech person. We presented from Region 2 our new stormwater filter system, and he's very excited about it. So, Sandy, if you could show that, please.
Some
real biological treatment.
Recycling of the big chunks.
And I know there's a plentiful supply of them because look at our garbage cans. So I just thought that was the greatest picture, so we could share that with everybody. And Tam, you could take that to Sacramento and tell them cities are really working hard at what we're trying to do out there. So back to business here. Introductions, we do have Tam here, and I don't believe you have any new staff introductions.
Nope,
for sure. So Tam, would you come forward, and thank you, Sandy, for that IT work for me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you once again for your continuing commitment to the work that we all do under very, very difficult circumstances. And as you are aware, all the talk in Sacramento these days are on budgets and, well, budget, and budget appointments and the new administration coming in and all that. The governor did release his proposed budget on Monday. And as I'm sure you've heard by now, there's like a $25.4 billion budget gap that he's trying to address through combination of activities, let's just put it that way. With respect to the water boards, what the governor is proposing in his budget is really two things that I would say as significant. The first is a funding shift of $12.8 million from general fund to the waste discharge permit fund and water rights fund. This is not new. This fund shift has been proposed in the past. And, for example, last year was proposed, but then at the last minute, due to various concerns from various sectors, general fund was found to fill that hole. So we were not required to increase those funds significantly last year. I don't know if that would be possible again this year, but as of right now, there is that proposed $12.8 million fund shift for us. The new aspect to this is also a proposal, a legislative proposal, which I believe will be submitted to as a statutory change to authorize the water boards to assess fees for basin planning. As you may know, all of our activities in basin planning, TMDL development, basin planning update, review, all of that have been based on general fund activities. And so this would authorize us, and obviously we would have to do it with a great deal of care and thought and planning and a great deal of prioritization, too, in my opinion. But if it is approved, then the Water Board would be able to address those basin planning activities through some fees. This is a critical matter because, as you know, all of our activities, permits, TMDLs are based on our basin plan, based on objectives, based on beneficial use designation, and there's been concerns from the environmental community as well as from the regulatory community with respect to how some of those basin plans need to be further updated. I think Mr. Moore has several times indicated there are water bodies that he felt could be looked at and improved upon in the basin plan. So this obviously is an important area for us. So we'll see how the budget discussion proceed with respect to these two items. There are also, hopefully that's not me, there are also proposals with respect to personnel savings and reduction that I don't have all the details on. I don't know if Bruce does. I think the governor is proposing additional, I'm not sure if it's additional or continuation of the salary reductions that our staff and board member too have realized over the past few years. I think all those things are still up in the air, still to be discussed, but I would not be surprised at if at minimum the current reductions are maintained at least for a while. So that's all the budget news that is news right now. We'll continue to keep you updated, and of course, Bruce will keep you updated as this thing progresses on the budget front. Since the chairman mentioned stormwater, I wanted to make you aware that after many years, the State Water Board has finally released for public comment the draft Caltrans MS4 stormwater permit. The comment deadline is in March, and we expect to go to hearing in July. This is significant for us because the Caltrans permit is the first of three stormwater permits that we are hoping to address this year. And so right on the heel of the Caltrans permit, the industrial general stormwater permit is expected to be released on January 28th. And then the Phase 2 small MS4 permit is expected to be released on February 21st. So we are definitely focusing on stormwater permitting as one of our key priority areas for this year.
Thank you, Tim. Questions for State Board Rep? All right, you're smiling, Steve.
As usual, Ms. Dodek always has some pretty profound news coming from State Board. You know, those are big items that she's reported on.
I guess I would add one more. For those of you who have worked with or know Mr. Baggett, Mr. Art Baggett on our board, as of this morning, I was told that January 19th, next Wednesday, will be his last day on the State Water Board. So if you wish to, I think he would welcome a note. He's been on the board for three terms, 12 years, and obviously has left a significant body of accomplishments for all of us.
Good, thank you. Maybe we can put together a card, staff, and we'll send a note to him and thank him for his years of service on the State Board. So thank you for that. That concludes our introductions, I believe, and so we will move on to the next item, too, and our legal counsel, Ms. Dickey and Mr. Urey, thank you for updating us on the procedure here. A little refresher for all of us helps, and so at this time, if I may, I'll turn it over to Vice Chair Young for this item on the agenda.
Yes, we would like to now take nominations for chair of the board for the coming year. If anyone has a nomination.
Yes. I appreciate John Mueller working here, and I would like to nominate him again as a chair for 2011.
I would like to second that nomination.
I'd like to second it also.
I'm just looking forward to when I get enough seniority to make the nomination of
It's going to be a long time.
Let the record show there was a stampede for seconding a nomination which requires no second. I'm also told that I, despite the comity of the board here, do need to open it, open up the nomination process to the floor to see if anyone else has an additional nomination.
I move that nomination for the chair be closed.
Not sure whether that's legitimate, but that joins the stampede. All right, hearing no additional nominations. Should we take a roll call vote, or is this a voice vote?
Yes. Well, by show of hands.
Let's have a roll call vote because it's so much fun.
We can send him a copy. You know, he actually does retire.
I guess this is a yay or nay roll call vote, since there is one nomination.
Mr. Aliyah?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Aye.
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 Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. It seems like the last few days we've been to a lot of swearing-ins and a lot of changing of the guards of many different positions in the state. So I'm very privileged and humble. I think that's the word they're using. I was last night for the Board of Supervisors, but I think first and foremost, I'd like to thank the staff for what they're doing, and I think we're all realizing we're all doing more with less, and that's very important. And I know the dedication is there, and if we're going to lose a cell phone or something, don't worry about it. You still have your jobs. I understand. That's the important part. And secondly, as I've said before, and the board here is without a doubt the finest board you'd ever want to work for in the history of my 10 years as chair. So I could have broken a record there for whatever that means, and I don't know if that's good or bad, but it is truly a privilege to serve with such a wonderful board, and vice chair always covers for me in that tough month of October when we try to make a living. But this year we had some good, horrible rains in October on Sundays to boot, so it was a tough time to be a pumpkin farmer, but we got through it. So thank you very much for this opportunity, and I'll try to continue to be fair and represent all the people of our great region too here. So I appreciate the opportunity, and my wife this morning at 4:30 said, "Do I really have to go with you?" I said, "Not this year, maybe next year when it's over." She said, "You've been saying that for 10 years." So I said, "Stay in bed for another couple minutes." But anyway, we'll move on to vice chair. So at this time, if I may, I could run the election for vice chair. And so I'd ask for a nomination for vice chair.
Yes, I would like to nominate Terry Yang, Dr. Terry Yang, as a vice chair.
Second.
Been moved and second. Any further nominations? If not, motion to close nominations for vice chair.
So moved.
And second?
Second.
Moved and second. Roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr. Eliopoulos?
Yes.
Mr.
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Yes.
Thank you, or abstain, whatever is appropriate.
Just say yes.
Yes.
Yes, wholeheartedly, as we're all saying right now. I think we're all in very good spirits with excluding myself, our leadership in California right now in the Bay Area. We're all kind of on a roll, and so Dr. Young, if you'd like to say a couple words, please.
Well, I'm not sure that I can add anything to what the chairman has already said. We all sincerely appreciate the staff's work. the level of professionalism and level of scientific expertise and thoughtfulness that the staff puts into this work is just phenomenal, and we appreciate it very much. We also appreciate the efforts of the permittees and the community at large and the environmental community in making the operations of this board hopefully the best that they can be. We very much appreciate your earnest involvement in all of these issues, and we learn, speaking for myself at least, I learn a great deal from the comments that we get every month and appreciate them very much. And thank you as well to my fellow board members, from whom I also learn a great deal every month and respect very highly. And to our representative to the State Board, Tam, we love seeing you here. We really appreciate the fact that you are such an effective force on the State Board, but also so effective in representing us and helping us to deal with our issues here in the Bay Area. So thank you again to everyone.
Very good. Congratulations. And looking forward, all of us, to a great 2011, and hopefully some more positive things come out of this board, as has been in the last 14 years that I've been here. So at this time, we'll move on to item 3, the public forum, and I have one card. Stephen Knight, please.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the board. My name is Stephen Knight. I'm the political director for Save the Bay. And this was a great setup for my comment. We are on a roll, and it's a result of leadership, and which is not always an easy thing to demonstrate. And I wanted to come today to thank the board for its leadership. You all probably saw that the city of San Jose passed a ban on single-use bags last month, the strongest ban in the United States of America, applying to all retailers. And this is a great victory for the Bay and the waters of the state and the nation, really the world, and a victory for the leadership of this board. Your own executive officer spent two long days in San Jose, has testified in front of the city council there in favor of this bag ban, and has very articulately reminded that council of the place of stormwater management and the municipal regional permit as it fits into this positive kind of feel-good action that the council is taking. In our Clean Bay project at Save the Bay, we're working with cities and counties all around the Bay Area, emphasizing as we try to get them to pass source reduction bills like styrofoam bans and plastic bag bans, putting that in the same way in the context of the MRP and compliance and the need to comply with their permits from the Water Board. And I'm looking forward, actually, to editing the video from the San Jose City Council comments and showing Mr. Wolf's clip to city councils, because it's very effective and clear statement. And so I just wanted to come and say that, and say we are also, of course, looking forward to the Water Board showing leadership in using its enforcement powers to reduce trash in San Francisco Bay under the term of this permit. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, we can start.
If I might add, I sincerely appreciate the efforts of Save the Bay in bringing this issue onto the table and making it clear what was entailed in the educational efforts. I guess it's been said about David somewhat that it's better to have on your side. I think you've been very effective, and we could not have done it by any means without you.
Thank you, Board Member Picot.
if it would be possible sometime for you to come back and give us an update on the status of the styrofoam in this region, that would be a very valuable thing, unless you can do it off the top of your head right now. That's putting you on the spot, isn't it?
I would be glad to come back. I would say there has been a lot less controversy around styrofoam bans and a lot more progress, and we're seeing a number of them here in this county. The state bill last year, Jerry Hill sponsored a state bill that did not pass, but continuing to make progress in cities to analogize to San Jose, which has styrofoam on its back burner right now, to see bans in cities the size of that and outside of the usual suspects of, say, Berkeley, San Francisco, to see the cities the size and leadership of San Jose, that's building a floor under an eventual state bill. So I'd be glad to come back.
Thanks for those reports. And, you know, on the styrofoam thing, I think it's fresh in all of our minds. You know, this trash issue is a very public issue. And just as citizens, you know, when we go through the holiday season and we see all the packaging that comes with the internet orders, and you know, I'd drive down the freeway and then, you know, whoops, somebody just dropped a cardboard box and it was full of peanuts and they're everywhere and they're going to go into the ocean, you know. And so I think this issue is sort of fresh in our minds with the holidays and everything. And sure, cities can ban them, but these packages come from all over the country. So as you've pointed out, this is a national issue. It's a global issue. And it's really a privilege to work with your organization and others and enlightened city and county leadership to make a message clear from this region. And I think we can have a big impact that's global. Thank you.
If I may make a quick comment to changing hats as a city councilman in Half Moon Bay recently, we were the last city in the Bay Area, I think, that did not have mandatory solid waste pickup. And I thank the staff at the regional board and also Baykeepers for sending a letter to our city to encourage us to vote for mandatory solid waste pickup. And it was amazing. I mean, we probably had over 300 residents that did not have mandatory solid waste pickup. And we had a number of complaints saying, well, why do we have to have garbage pickup, you know? And so they got it, and I happened to use a little bit of my separation of powers of water board duties and encourage my fellow councilmen, which they were totally in support of it. But those things happen out there. And just quickly on this plastic bag ban, I think there's a possibility to look at kind of a plastic ban light to get us started in that process. Might be a good idea if we could work with smaller communities to figure out a way, and I've been thinking about that, not to just hit them over the head overnight, because as a farmer's market vendor, I'm just as guilty by using plastic bags for our produce, you know, and so there's got to be a way we could start the process gradually to shift over. And there's actually a comment in here. I'm going to comment later during the chair's report. But anyway, thank you. And that's yes. Board member saying?
I think I should make some comment about plastic bags ban in San Jose. City Council voted, with the one exception, one city councilman did not vote for this ban. And my area city councilman came to my home and he gave me a clothes bag to carry to the grocery store. It was a token of appreciation, but came to my home, asked Calva, and he said, I want to give you, he calls me uncle, so that's the privilege of being a little senior, I guess. You know, the plastic ban is not complete because there are a lot of tiny cities around San Jose. They don't ban it, something like Campbell or Santa Clara or Milpitas or Morgan Hill. We are surrounded by the cities, and there are a lot of shopping. There are some Indian grocery stores. I go to Santa Clara. They will not be banned. Also, the plastic bags will not be banned if you take something from a restaurant or something. There are some limited exceptions to the rule. The major problem has been there was some opposition over there that what will be the economic impact of the plastic ban. I don't know there is an inconvenience factor, but I don't think that there is economic impact, because I go to Costco and shop there, and they don't give any bag. They will give you a cardboard box if you want to carry it, but they're all packaged and big bags, and you carry them. So I think we have to adapt to it, get used to it. I think we have spoiled our habits. But I just like to make one comment, and maybe somebody can say. Somebody told me that if you use the clothes bag over and over again and put some grocery or some vegetables or fruits and carry it home and empty them, over a period of time, if you don't clean them and don't keep them clean, they develop bacteria in it. Sometimes they can get dirty and develop because you reuse over a period of time. I'm not very sure that any study has been done on what is the danger there. Plastic bag is fresh every time you use and throw them away. But we'll be reusing this hand carrying limited amount when you're going to have to. So I was not sure about that. Let me make one more comment before I leave this mic I have in front of me, the privilege of having it. I have been reading a lot of news about global warming. Last month, somebody sent me an article. What they're kidding about is not a global warming, but it really is a global cooling taking place. This guy has put all kinds of logic behind it. I don't know if you have seen the article. He was completely negating the whole news. I was so surprised by this guy, somewhere from, I don't know. But maybe you can go to Google and search for global cooling and find that article. Read about it and see what you think about it. Thank you very much.
Good. So, again, I think on the permanent bags and the carry-in, it's like anything. If we have good practices of cleaning things, I don't think there's an issue there. I could talk a little bit about food safety here in a minute. And I know in our garage with the carry bags, my wife has a cat, enjoys sleeping in them too, so it works out pretty well. So between the cat hair and produce, it all mixes together. It's probably good for your immune systems. I don't know. So who would have ever thought?
And the raccoons.
It goes along with my raccoon buddies there. But moving on, in all seriousness, we had anticipated that Ellen Junk was going to be here to introduce the new executive of Bay Planning Coalition, but I don't believe she's here.
I've not seen her.
Right, but as we understand it, it's John Coleman.
Right. Yeah. Ellen Junk has been the executive director, the only executive director of Bay Planning Coalition for the last 28 years, and she wants to embark on some new ventures. It's not going to be outside the Bay Area, but...
old stuff.
She's done a master's in cultural anthropology that she wants to plug into her environmental work, and I think Bay Planning Coalition was very pleased to be able to appoint John Coleman, who's known to many of you, I think, as East Bay MUD's board member for the San Ramon Valley area, but appoint him as executive director. So I think that's going to be a strong help, because that organization has done a lot of outreach to Sacramento and to Washington for Bay causes. So we'll look forward to working with them through a transition. I know John's going to have a learning curve, but we'll try to make sure we have a chance to get him over here to meet all of you.
Great, thank you, and bear with us here quickly. It's been a long 2 months since we've been together. Anyhow, so we'll move on to item four, minutes from the April 14th, 2010 board meeting. May I get a motion to approve?
So move.
Second.
Moved and second to approve minutes of April 14, 2010. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So ordered. Again, as they say, I beg your patience for a quick minute here on item five, chair, board members, executive officers report. It's been a busy, believe it or not, a couple of months. First thing quickly, I had the opportunity to be invited back to EPA in November. I missed the meeting here. And I won't go into the details, but we met with the administrator and all the key staff members, and we received the 2011-2015 EPA strategic plan. I don't know if anybody has it, but the quick goals are going to be EPA's mission to protect human health and environment, taking action on climate change and improving air quality, 2, protecting America's waters, 3, cleaning up communities and advancing sustainable development, 4, ensuring the safety of chemicals and preventing pollution, and 5, enforcing environmental laws. And the core values of our EPA is science, transparency, and rule of law. And it was a very good meeting, and unfortunately, I've termed out of that one. I'm not going to be able to serve on this committee any longer, but had one last chance to be back there. And my theme was, and I think it's all of our theme for 2011, is to be sharing and sharing what resources and what wisdom and knowledge we have with each other and all of us to kind of bring us all together to get through these difficult times. So, and shifting gears quickly, they were unaware, and I had the opportunity to the next item on early December, attended a food safety, water quality, co-management conference in Watsonville with a number of major environmental groups and growers and brokers. And our big issue from the water quality standards, which we've talked about before, was that, and I brought it up to EPA, and they were really kind of unaware of it. FDA has gone through our new food safety thing, and the leafy green industry was talking about stripping out all our buffer zones and all our grassy swales and all the things that we've all worked on and all of you have worked on for many, many years. And so I don't think it's as drastic as we first thought. Naturally, the pressure was being put on by the big buyers of leafy greens saying we can't buy anymore because you got animals nearby, and you know, you can't have a cat in the barn anymore. I have 2. I'm sorry. If you want to buy from me, I got 2 cats. So I think I'd rather have the Tommy and Oreo in there than rat bait or mice bait or whatever you want to call it. So they kind of overstepped things, but we're trying to work through that. And it was a very good conference down there. It wasn't as shocking as I first thought it was. And trust me, we're not pulling out our grassy swales yet in buffer zones. But there has been a few people that in the big production areas down in Hollister, Watsonville, Salinas that have been encouraged to do that. So they'd like to have it clear as this. So that was one thing. And the other thing quickly, at EPA, we're learning new things in the world of fuels, and the big deal back there is the hydraulic fracturing or fracking, which I don't think we have any of that going on out this close in California, but there's a huge concern for that out. Is there some going on out here?
No, it's a big deal.
Yeah, huge deal that we have to all be aware of, and that was new to us. And keep going here quickly as possible for us all is I was very glad to hear that the farmers are seeking local solutions to frost protection in the Russian River, which the State Board has worked really hard on and encouraged. And Chairman Hoppen has really mentioned that they should go through a local solution and do the best they can to come up with this. And I know we're working on our grazing TMDL and things like that. And these are things that are very, very encouraging. So I brought this to share. And that's another thing. And I'll give that to the Vice Chair to read over. And then I did have a couple of chairs calls, and we just had one Monday, and Tam kind of updated you on the quorum issues. Just Region 1 and Region 3 have some issues. Region 3 has some issues regarding the ag waiver situation down there. And we heard about the budget and administrative changes and dissemination of information on ACL actions. A lot of the board chairs thought we should all know what other regions are doing. I guess the state used to send out a report to all of us, and so we're trying to figure out a way to share that. And I finally, they've taken my suggestion. We haven't had a face-to-face chairs meeting in the state in many years. Years ago, we used to have that, and I highly encourage that because of budget issues. And so we're going to get one on March 22nd, the same time the executive officers are all meeting up there again, so we'll be able to visit on situations. For all of us, the WQCC agenda, we're working on that, and that will be September 26th and 27th. So if you could save those dates on your calendars. And I think that's just about everything I had to say. Normally these chairs call, we do go in at 5 p.m. on Mondays, first Monday of the month, and we spend over an hour together, so it is a little bit of time commitment. And once in a while, you hear a dog barking in the background or a young child yelling and screaming at someone, but we're doing our best we can there. So I'm hoping that's it. So other board members, reports,
well,
Vice Chair?
I wanted to ask a question following up on your report on the food safety measures. I know that I believe that the president signed the food safety bill, and no doubt there will be new regulations coming out of the Food and Drug Administration on that. And since we have Board Member Doduk here, I thought this might be a time to suggest that if it is warranted, and if the state board wants to bring together various regions who are concerned about this issue, that not only Chairman Mueller, but I'm also very interested in the issue and would be willing to put in some extra time to work with other regions to see that we're all on the same wavelength on this.
Great suggestion. I think that's very important. I know there's some exemptions out there that they're looking at, and I'm not sure exactly where the bill stands right now. I know it has been signed, but I don't know the details totally on that. But I think that's a great suggestion, Tam, and you might be able to, again, put together a little ad hoc committee of board members from the regions and kind of work with you at the state level to see if we can ensure that we're all pulling in the same direction. Good, thank you. Yes, Board Member Singh.
You know, last month or sometimes ago, I made a little noise about Chromium 6, and apparently the state came forward and set a new limit on Chromium 6 at 0.02 parts per billion. I don't know how it will be enforced, but the Chromium 6 in the waters have been found in San Jose area and many other areas. So that was a concern, and in fact, it is a carcinogenic. Also, I read a report that some of the cities which are fluoriding, putting fluoride in their water, they are doing an excessive quantity, and it is beyond the need, and they are looking at revising the limit on the fluoride content of the water. You must have read this news also about this one. I don't have the latest what they decided, but the final decision on that. One thing I would like to say that I sent an email to only Bruce, not to anybody else, that governor gave his report on the budget, but he didn't mention, because there had been noise that civil service, state of California, taking a bigger chunk of money, pension money, but he didn't mention anything about pension or tampering with it. I don't know if something will be forthcoming. So at least we are in one area safe. And I had a communication with the mayor of San Jose, Chuck Reed, very much concerned about dumping of mattresses, furnitures, appliances on the roadside by the people, and it is happening in the rainwater, and they dump in the nighttime, and they run away. And I just called Mayor. I said, Mayor, this is just getting to be outrageous. I drive by and see these things over there. He said, the city has been spending money, that's what he told me, trying to pay for this illegal dumping, but the law is such that unless policeman sees personally himself, he cannot cite it. The only other way, if you want to help the cause, is that if you see somebody dumping, take a picture and get the license number, and you become a witness, and we'll follow through on that. Now, that's difficult in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock. Somebody goes to dump it, that I will be a witness. I said, Mayor, I will not be able to do it. We need to take some action on this thing, because this thing is getting to be a big crime. It is cheaper for people to take the mattresses and dump on the roadside somewhere rather than to take it to the dump ground. So that's kind of a lot of issues are going on, and some of the things I had on my mind, I don't know if this board can do anything about this because it is the dumping business. I don't know if you have the problem in Half Moon Bay or not, but the city of San Jose, I noticed people as the dumping.
I think Board Member Singh, there's not a spot in the world that does not have a dumping issue, and I don't know the answer We have just renegotiated a solid waste contract also when we were talking about our mandatory service. And trying to figure out a way for the underserved out there that if they do have large items that need to be taken to the landfill, maybe they could get a kind of a little break on it. But then you're dealing with the county and all their fees and things like that. But we're thinking about those things because those are an issue. And in open space and agriculture, we're seeing more and more dumping going on. And so I think we all have to monitor ourselves too. So, yes.
We don't usually get in the weeds here quite this much, but I will offer to you folks that Oakland has a program where there is one free pickup per year of large bulky waste, and all you have to do is pick up the phone. Many people still don't. We still have dumping, but at least that's a step in the right direction, and it takes care of a lot of the problem.
I think our new mayor of Oakland here is working like as fast as possible for that, and if anyone has a good contact to get to our mayor, and thank you, Sandy, for pictures we've had presenting the mayor with different awards over the council member with awards after reading this morning the work she's trying to do in Zone 33, I believe it is. 33X. It doesn't sound good. I'd like just on a personal level to try to reach them and see if there's some way we could get them some vegetable seeds or garden seeds that are expired for us, but yet give to that community so maybe they could get a hold of us and we could donate them a little bit, try to get some gardening going. So, okay, board members, back to you. Sorry it's been about my discussion here for a while, but let's see what we have. So, Dr. Singh, board member Moore, we'll start there.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Congratulations on your election.
Thank you.
Yes, I've got my oranges here to celebrate Stanford's Orange Bowl victory. So cardinal and orange, it's a nice combination, don't you think?
Definitely.
So, yeah. As we look at 2011, we've got lots of challenges ahead with the budget and everything, and I just wanted to reiterate, the board's appreciation for staff efforts. The executive officer's report each month, including last month, is always a real pleasure to dig into the details of what we're doing. The staff presentations this last month are very impressive, from groundwater to the multi-regional issues that we're getting into, and so I just want to thank all your efforts. In getting down to a detail, I'm getting ahead in the agenda, but, the report on the case closures, we're setting targets, we're meeting them, with the exception of the Department of Defense sites, which, is an issue with the state and the federal government, it always will be. So I just wanted to thank the staff. And then for today, it seemed we have a light agenda, so I'm hoping to maybe just tell a little story. It might take a few minutes. And also, I want to leave some time for Board Member McGrath to talk about something we've been discussing last month. So I'll let him talk about that issue. I added three letters after my name this last couple months. I became a qualified SWIP developer. Because in my company, they look to me and the engineering firm and say, well, what do we need to do to comply with the new construction general permit?
And you may need to explain what a SWIFT is.
Yes. That's not the Vietnam SWIFT boat thing.
Well, this is
you're
kind
too
of
young
funny.
For that.
That's what's kind of funny. Yeah, the SWIFT boat. What's funny about, it's actually an acronym embedded in an acronym, the S part, the QSD, Qualified Stormwater Pollution Prevention Plan Developer. And it's an issue of great importance. This time of year, we see the results of poor construction management. Those of us that are water-minded get a fairly strong reaction. I know I can speak for myself, and I know my fellow board members and staff and people we work with on this issue, when we see a beautiful stream buried in fine sediment, because not because of willful pollution or that sort of thing, but just lack of education, lack of knowledge, lack of understanding the way water works in the urban environment and how it supports critical ecological functions that we rely on. And it's such a shame. So it was a bold step forward that the State Board adopted the construction general permit. And so But I wanted to tell a little story about, you know, what this looks like on the ground a little bit. Because there is, I'd say, a gulf between maybe the contracting industry and that sort of thing and the type of structure that we all are used to in terms of reporting and accountability. So there's a cultural gulf that still remains. Now, to the State Board's credit, we've built in a grace period, you know, a period of time. And on a positive note, I think the training that's been put in place is structurally, it has integrity. It reiterates the learning process about how to comply with this permit. But it's multi-layered. It raises the issue that we have raised with the urban runoff permit about this philosophical fundamental issue. And Dr. Mumley and I kind of, you know, repeat in our consideration of things like the municipal regional permit, which is how much effort do we expend on doing work to protect water quality versus how much work we do documenting and reporting the work we've done. I think the state board and regional boards, our challenge in this type of economic situation, but even moving forward in terms of a sustainable program, is to find that right balance between the reporting and the actual work. Because getting back to my point about the gulf between the low-bid contracting community that builds the infrastructure renewal that this board, these staff want to see happen to protect water quality, stormwater, wastewater, et cetera. That gulf is still large, and getting that culture to do the type of internet upload on the level of complexity that is anticipated or as this grace period for the construction general permit passes, it's daunting. And, you know, and the infrastructure to set it up is struggling a bit. I haven't gotten my exam results yet, but I did pass. It was my goal to break the curve, you know, my competitive side. But it's been a couple months. So, you know, the actual infrastructure to support the training and certification, it's a challenge. And I want to commend everyone with the vision that set it up, but I'm concerned about the level of reporting that's part of this, and even our efforts to track it effectively. Now, that said, I'll move on into, you know, something substantive for staff. You know, in the end, you know, I want to just encourage, you know, for our reputation as a science-based technical regional board that is results-based, I want to encourage our staff that work in this program not to be tempted to just go after low-hanging fruit of the reporting mistakes that may happen. That's the easy thing for a regulatory agency to do, is to focus its enforcement action on more of a gotcha approach about, oh, you didn't get that rain event action plan in 48 hours ahead of that storm that was predicted on the NOAA website, and you should have been looking at that. I want to encourage us to always maintain a focus on a results-based implementation. We have limited resources, and, you know, as a board member, I want to see enforcement of the construction general permit focused on sites that are causing a real environmental problem. You know, with all the layers in this permit, and I took a test on it, I know about them. It's pretty significant, but I say it's important. And then also for the State Board's efforts as we move forward, I encourage a critical review of what we've set up as we move forward into implementation of industrial general permit and other aspects. How are we doing with this complex regulatory vision? What can we do to improve it, to make it effective, getting back to the results that we want to see? So, and then finally, catch my breath a little bit. You know, one of the things in the gulf between our regulatory process and the contracting community and the low bid and all that is I don't think they understand the difference between erosion control and sediment control. You know, I want us to be pretty hip, you know, they say knowledgeable to this important difference. If you leave your sediment control measures in place after you're done with your job, you could cause more of a problem than, you know, you're trying to solve. Once you move out of construction phase into post-construction, you need to move from sediment control to erosion control. And the contracting community doesn't get that yet. Maybe they do in the subdivision world, but in my world, pipeline and small footprint construction, they don't understand it yet. So, let alone the reporting requirements of the permit. So, finally, you know, a gulf, you can't really build a bridge over. Are there any bridges over any gulfs in the world? You can build a bridge over a bay. So there's a ways to go. The grace period is a couple years. I think it could be longer, but I encourage the state board and the regional board staff to recognize the challenge of getting people trained, you know, to comply with this permit. But it's that community is pretty apprehensive about the program. And as long as we recognize the importance of results and environmental protection as the guiding light, then we can maintain our reputation as a practical, solution-oriented board. So it's real important to me.
Very good. Thank you, Board Member Moore. Board Member McGrath, you want to clean that up?
I'd be happy to, and I'm gonna tell a little story.
Y'all have to remember, we've been away from each other for a while, so bear with
that.
Us. Petaluma, thank you. San Francisco, thank you. And whoever else, thank you. But stick with us. We'll get through it all.
Steve's point about education is important, and I'm going to analogize to the first graders that I volunteer in their class. This year, there were 8 kids that acted up out of 23 in the classroom. Class size had gone up from about 18 to 23, and there were 8 kids with pretty significant educational issues in the classroom. It's a teacher I'd work with quite a bit, and the first week I just said, God, I don't know if I want to do this. I don't know if I can do this. And come January, and they're all back from school, all but 2 or 3 of those kids are closing the reading gaps in ways that I know they got a good chance of being at grade level by the end of the year. So, you know, you can't despair, and you got to keep the educational process in mind. I think Steve is absolutely correct. So with that, as you know, I'm your representative to BCDC, and as most of you know, I think there's a climate change set of bay plans, which has run into quite a bit of controversy. So right at the end of the year, I talked a little bit with the vice chair about whether or not that should show up on our agenda, whether or not the regional board should do anything about that, because it has implications for the waters that we regulate. And she said, well, why don't you talk to Steve Moore and Andy Gunther? And I pulled those together. And if you don't know Andy, he was a scientist at the Aquatic Habitat Institute before it was the Estuary Institute. He is a climate scientist. Mitch Avalon, who is the deputy director of Contra Costa County for Public Works, and Phil Stevens, who's the executive director of the Urban Creeks Council. And just said, you know, I posed that question to them, if you were me, what would you do about sea level rise? And we had a pretty wide-ranging 3-hour discussion about what it meant. And the bottom line in terms of the workload here is that this is something which is going to unfold over the next 30 years. So it doesn't, I think, need to be a high priority in the current agenda with the budget problems that we have or local government has. At the same time, it's very clear to us that the flood control agencies don't have the capacity, and I'm talking about institutional capacity, either financial or staffing, or the bonding capacity to deal with this. Proposition 13 left them essentially unable to maintain the facilities they have. And if you look at Pinole Creek, which is one of the examples that certainly caught my attention, this was an Army Corps of Engineers flood control project built to convey a theoretical 50-year storm. It now conveys about a 15-year storm. And the reasons for that are the assumptions that we had about sediment in watersheds and our ability to engineer hard flood control structures at the bottom of the watersheds were wrong. We didn't understand the amount of sediment delivered. We didn't understand how expensive dredging was going to become. The agreements that we reached in terms of maintaining the facilities aren't reasonable. And there are more extreme examples of this, such as San Lorenzo Creek in going through Santa Cruz, but the literature is fairly clear that we didn't have it right. We did our best, but we didn't have it right. The second aspect is that flood control agencies have no influence over land use. And the rules at the time said to calculate flood facilities for what you have. But watershed development has continued and, in some cases, dramatically increased the rate of runoff. There has been nothing there that required any contribution from those people that benefited about getting their stormwater efficiently and rapidly, and perhaps with trash, to the watercourses. So we have those problems, but it's primarily a problem that entails, and I'll go back to the educational motive. It entails at this stage a coalition building and educational effort, not a regulatory effort. And I think that was the fairly clear consensus among us that even with the resources to deal with it, the mechanism to deal with it is coalition building. Now, what was of interest, so what I am doing is putting together our conclusions and recommendations into a little white paper that I will send to our executive director and to Will Travis. So we're going back and forth with the editing. But along the way, what I discovered is that Sean Randolph, the chairman of BCDC, has been asked by Dianne Feinstein to look into the financial issues of protecting the bay in terms of wetland restoration and particularly flood control. So there is, in fact, an interest out there that we certainly didn't know about that when we began working on this. But I'm trying to plug in and finalize this thing by the end of the week so it can provide some background for essentially the problem statement and a series of recommendations from that panel. So, as they say, sometimes it's better to be lucky in your timing than good. And I think we were fortuitous, but I really appreciate the pulling together of all those efforts and to try to look at this from the board perspective, but in a non-traditional regulatory perspective, because it's a matter of trying to get this slow-moving problem to be realized and dealt with in fiscally responsible ways that, by the way, will probably do some things to enhance our streams. So it's a little interesting piece of work.
Hello, Chair. I think they made a little comment about sedimentation. I'd like to make a little comment about from my knowledge of teaching a class on sediment hydraulics. First of all, let me point out something. I don't want to make it a class over here, but point out something.
I'm not going to let you.
Because that's what has been over here going on here. We're trying to teach something to us. You know, erosion comes before sedimentation. We should remember erosion is the beginning of the sediment production. And also, please, most of the sediment erosion or transportation takes place in the high floods because it's proportional to fourth time the power of discharge. Now, but I would like to bring over here in this country, it has not caught up, but nowadays, in every sediment hydraulics course, there is a chapter on a regime theory. I don't know if you have heard of it or not, called a regime theory. There is a natural balance on the rivers. The young rivers have not reached their natural balance. But long, old rivers, they reach a natural balance. Their sedimentation and erosion is approximately maintained over a period of time. There is a relationship between the width and slope of the river and many other factors that it reaches. So every time you take a step to control erosion or sedimentation, if it is not in tune with the natural balance, the delta formation will continue. When the delta, Mississippi River, every river, sedimentation, that nature is trying to level everything, you know. So you can control to a certain extent. But one of the thing in this country is slowly coming, and I have seen some report by U.S. Geological Survey on the regime theory, that there is a natural balance. And if you disturb that balance, the nature will try to compensate it. If you build a dam or build a sediment control, then water downstream becomes cleaner and it has certain capacity, carrying capacity to erode the bank, and it will erode the bottom of the channel. So every design, I think what we go wrong over here, that we don't consider the natural balance of the river mechanics. And that's called regime theory. So I don't want to say too much on this subject over here because it gets a little complicated. But we can do all we can. But I think there is a natural process involved. That's what I would like to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Have a quick, and maybe you could share that with Steve and Jim, too, in their work. So thank you. Board Member Peacock. Board Member Elihu.
On a personal note,
pull your mic.
I have a new grandson, number 6.
All right.
Uh-oh, here we go. That's okay. Another Capricorn?
Another Capricorn.
We had a good horoscope today. I checked it out. That's how I get through my day. I look at the horoscope and the chronicle. Oh, boy. That'll work. Congratulations, Board Elham. And I'm sure you haven't been in the deep snow like a year ago. Is that correct?
No, okay, I give up.
Yeah, that's okay.
Completely.
Vice Chair, please.
Well, I was going to say something about how successional theory in ecology is sort of analogous to regime theory in hydrology, but I think I'll say
let's
that.
See, let's get back to our raccoons. So, thank you. All right.
Just a few. Let me try to clean up all these comments that have
yeah,
been made.
Really. Where's all our PhDs out yeah. here? Help.
Just to touch base on the budget, Tim gave you the high points that there is effort to shift general fund to fees. The overall dollars in our budget for 11-12 essentially are the same. Personnel is essentially the same, but what that does is pretty much maintain the reductions that we've had over the past year or so. Both the I'd mentioned during the fall that the governor had implemented a 10% salary savings versus the historic 5% salary savings. The way that played out was they essentially took 5% of our dollars and positions, so that first you take 5% and then you get back to managing it as if it's a 5% salary savings. What that's resulted in is that in the fall we did have to give back some positions, and now we're at the point, I look back, that we're essentially at our staffing levels from 1992-93 budget year, nearly 20 years ago, but it's clear the things that we're responsible for and required to do have significantly grown during that time. So that's our challenge moving forward. The other challenge continues on the personnel side that, as Tam said, there's a number of expectations in Governor Brown's budget in terms of staffing, and essentially they're starting from the perspective that the unions who have not reached settlement under Governor Schwarzenegger would reach settlement this spring, along the lines of what the unions that have already settled have done, which means that there would be a quote-unquote personal leave day each month. There'd be increased contribution to pensions. Right now, for those unions that have not reached settlement, they're still under a three-day-a-month furlough. And that's a challenge for us because our attorneys, our engineer geologists, our scientists at below the supervising level are all required to take 3 days a month within that month of furloughs, whereas the supervisors were under this personal leave program. We don't have to take that. We just have we accrue it and use it in place of vacation. So we are having the internal challenge that on any given day, a number of our staff will not be there because they need to take their furlough day during the month they earn it. And that's probably going to continue for a few months until the unions reach some level of settlement. But it does imply that not only is our staffing been reduced just in terms of numbers of people, but we still are on a reduction in terms of how much time we can actually spend on our work. So that's an ongoing challenge. I wanted to give you a brief update. We've talked about over the past couple of years our effort to amend the basin plan to include stream and wetland policy to augment our existing wetland policy and make sure it addresses all water bodies. And we're getting very close that on our work on that. The peer review on that is done. We have a final draft that staff has prepared. I see that Tom is actually reviewing it as we speak. And our goal is to put that out for public notice by the end of January so that we'll have that in front of you for consideration this fiscal year, in other words, by June. So that will be coming. Hand in hand with that is State Board has been working on statewide policy, which is a little bit different. It's working on definitions for the state of wetlands. A number of factors that are going to be applied more broadly on a statewide basis. And that's something we've been very active in. Diane's on the drafting team. I'm on the steering committee for that. There is an initial study and notice preparation that's out, that went out at the beginning of January. There's going to be workshops, two workshops, Sacramento and San Diego, over the coming month, and comments coming in. And peer review on that's about to start. So that's going to be something probably coming before State Board this calendar year, not necessarily this fiscal year. So that's something to we'll keep you posted on, but it certainly is going to be something that's coming in front of you. Following along the lines of CEQA actions and notice of preparation, many of you have gotten familiar with the proposal for a development in Redwood City on the Cargill salt processing plant there. It's called the Salt Works, naturally. And now the city of Redwood City has put out a notice of preparation for their CEQA document with comments due by February 28th. And we will certainly be commenting on that. In discussion with a couple of you, I said I'd summarize our comments in the executive officer's report, but we do plan to, as part of that notice of prep, just identify areas that we feel that definitely need to be addressed in the CEQA document, ranging from wetland or bay fill impacts to potential impacts on flood control, potential impacts on wastewater treatment, sea level rise, a number of things. So we'll be preparing that those comments, and it's going to be something that we'll need to pull in staff from a number of divisions because there are broad impacts across most of our divisions on that. Something else that's coming, and I expect we'll have some regulatory action this calendar year. You saw that San Francisco has been awarded the America's Cup competition for 2013. That impacts us because the Port of San Francisco, in fact, executive director has already talked to me saying they're going to want permits fairly quickly on the upgrades and all of the construction they're going to need to be doing in their port, in their wharf area. And by and large, we support this because we recognize that in many areas their wharves are quite old, do need work, and this is a good opportunity to get funding in to do that. So we'll keep you in the loop on that as that moves forward. And just to wrap up on the earlier discussion on bag ban, I think it's important to note that what San Jose did is not a plastic bag ban per se, but it's a single-use bag ban. And the significant thing that San Jose did was prepare a CEQA document evaluating the impacts throughout. This was an attempt to try to take a step back and say, okay, what are all the environmental impacts when you look at pulling out single-use bags from something that's become very comfortable in our day-to-day operation? And they went through a CEQA process, and as part of adopting their ordinance, they also certified the CEQA document. And that's going to become a good model for other cities, because that's been something that's tripped up other cities, that they have not done this same level of CEQA evaluation. And as they implement this, the ban will go into effect January 1, 2012. Initially, grocery stores will be able to sell a reusable or a recycled paper or other cloth bags, and they can sell that initially for 10 cents. They get to keep the money. And so the whole issue about, is this a fee, what San Jose was able to pass over that, because the city is not taking any money. Any sale of these bags comes back to the store itself. And then after a couple of years of ramping, the fee for that bag would be 25 cents. So I think it's a good model. We've heard that already a number of other cities are looking at that. I've already been contacted by some solid waste folks in other counties trying to get our support for various similar efforts, and I'm wholeheartedly giving them support and willing to go to city council meetings as necessary to do this, because as Stephen Knight said, it does have a direct nexus to our stormwater permit, and I think it is an opportunity for our stormwater permit to address trash where the public is actively involved, differing from the city needing to put in a capital project to control trash and maintain that. Here's where the public has a hands-on opportunity to control trash. So it's something we wholeheartedly support. So I'll continue to keep you posted on how this evolves over time.
Very good. Thank you. I think that concludes that item. It was a little lengthy today, but again, we've been out of circulation for a while, so we'll move on to maybe quickly on the America's Cup from the advisory capacity. Maybe Board Member McGrath could assist along the way, too, if they're looking for some advisors. He's quite familiar with the winds in the water and the dunkings. So,
and I'm sure this is going to be coming through BCDC fairly heavily, too.
So at this time, if I may, we'll have swearing in, please. All relevant evidence which any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing. First, by the board staff, secondly, by the discharger, third, by public agencies, and fourth, by any other interested persons. The board and staff counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, address, and whom he or she represents. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rule of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony which is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibit, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise, please. You promise to tell the truth.
So do.
Thank you. So, at this time, we move on. Is there one more thing there?
Item 6 is the consideration of uncontested items. I would like to recommend that item 6A, the reissuance of the NPDES permit for Bay Ship and Yacht Company, be continued. We've had a number of discussions on that permit reissuance with the Baykeeper, and as part of that, we have found that there may be additional discharges out of that facility that we need to tinker with the permit with to address. So we'll bring that back in a future month once we've...
Vice Chair, you or Board Member Moore would like to quick comment on that one?
Yes, I'm grateful in some respects that it is going to come go through a little bit more processing and receive a little bit more staff and other review. I did want to say two things about the trigger levels that were in this proposed permit, just for your edification in working through the potential revisions to what we see here. The first was that I was happy to see how the staff dealt with the question on how to set those trigger levels. I thought the resolution to that initial disagreement was very good, and I wanted to compliment you on that. I'm sorry about this cold. The second issue is what the trigger levels trigger once the swabs are found to be over the concentration limits that are set. And I had a few reservations about the fact that the actions that are triggered are basically revisions to the BMP program and then try it again and report annually. I was hoping that we could be a little bit more clear on what the what our board considered to be a successful and appropriate response to a concentration that was above a trigger level, and perhaps we could give both the regulated community and the members of the public a little bit more clarity on what we expect people to do if the trigger levels are exceeded by, let's say, 10, 20, 100 times versus just barely over the limit, what we expect them to do if the trigger levels are repeatedly, the same trigger level is repeatedly exceeded. And I don't want to be myself any more specific about that at this time, but I think this is an opportunity for everyone to take a step back and ask whether we can do something that gives a little bit more clarity and transparency to this process and doesn't. Y'all know my continuing theme about not wanting things that just generate processes. I want to know what the endpoint's going to be and how we define success. So hopefully this will be an opportunity for people to get a little bit creative on that score. Thank you. Oh, and I did want to say that that particular theme of mine is not directed towards any particular permittee, so I don't want anyone to take that as an implied criticism of the past performance of this particular permittee. It's just part of good governance.
Board Member Moore?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to speak, and thank you, Dr. Young, for those excellent comments. I echo those. I'd like to point out, and I told Bruce this, I found this item to be, an exemplary piece of staff work. And also a great interaction with meaningful analytical input from the environmental community. This was also by very striking a great balance with getting good technical input from the discharger about feasibility of implementation. This, to me, we're on the right track on taking this kind of a situation with potential pollution and making it fit our basin plant structure. There was a link made during the back and forth that's really where the authority of the board lies, and to do a technical translation ultimately to what action should be performed and how we perform the analysis without costing too much money. So I liked where, it was just really good staff work. We don't have to come out with the perfect product in a tentative order. We can use this process to refine it. We can come back to the next board meeting and get the action plan more better articulated. So I just wanted to commend the process, and I think it was a good decision to follow Dr. Young's direction on proceeding. Thank you.
Sure.
Board Member McGrath.
I endorse the comments of my fellow board members. I had been prepared, I thought, to vote for this, but I was going to ask a question of, certainly the ship building and maintenance facilities have improved dramatically in the 30 years that I know about it. And I would imagine that we're bumping up against some technical or feasibility limitations. And I would just like to have a little more information about that in there. I saw a very clear structure where the BMPs were submitted, but I'd kind of like to know a little more about where we're starting to hit the limitations. So I think that would help the transparency.
Very good. On comments,
may
Vice
I
Chair.
Just make sure everyone understands that this item was put off not because of any comments of the board members,
right,
but because something else came up in the permit, and that was a staff level decision.
Yes, sir.
Yes, thanks.
Very good. So I don't believe there's a vote needed on uncontested. Is that correct, staff?
I think. Do we need to vote to continue,
just a report,
or just?
It's just a report,
accept the continuation.
Sorry, Bruce. One more thing, and we talked about it. Sorry. Just for the record, also another good thing staff did here was to tie in that there's other facilities, and it's important to this board, as I understand, that we do never create an economic advantage through our regulatory process. So I saw that. I saw staff weighing that, thinking about other facilities and how it will be implemented there. Thank you.
So
I don't think there's a vote needed.
Right.
But again, I think also another from a business perspective, we have to look at the world trades of shipping and boating and waterways. I mean, it's pretty important. You do have to have some facilities to keep these people operating at a safe equipment and
right,
stuff like that.
Right.
So, again, it goes back to the business perspective. We don't want to be running them out of the area either and sending them to somewhere where they're not as conscious of what's going on underneath them.
Spoken like a true Navy man.
That's right. Whatever Navy's left in the Bay Area. So I think
so
we're okay.
Contested calendar, the other item, 6B, is a status report on the cleanup programs, and so that there's no need for a vote on that. That's just an information item.
Very good. So we'll move on to item 7. Thank you, Petaluma, and everyone. Vince, for your patience.
Item 7 is consideration of reissuance of the NPDES permit for the City of Petaluma's water recycling facility. So I would like Vince Christian to give the presentation on this item.
Thank you.
Is there, can you alter the light a little bit to see that a little better, or is that the way we always do it? Okay.
That'll help with the dimming.
There's some really nice photos in this. I'd like you to be able to see them.
There's nothing showing up on the screen yet. There we go.
That's better. Okay, thank you. Okay, good morning, Mr. Chairman and Board. My name is Vince Christian, and I'm a staff engineer in the NPDES Wastewater Division. Most of the presentations from our division involve complex technical and legal issues related to the permitting of wastewater discharges. There will be none of that today. I'm going to tell you about the Ellis Creek Water Recycling Facility in Petaluma. This is a success story about a city that had enough foresight to invest wisely in its future by recognizing the value of its environmental resources. Petaluma's original Hopper Street treatment facility was constructed in 1938. It was upgraded in 1966, and oxidation ponds were added in 1972. But by the early 1990s, many of their treatment units had exceeded their design life, so Petaluma started planning for a new plant. It struggled with how best to do this throughout the 90s, but construction finally began in 2005, and it started operating in January 2009. This is an aerial photo of the new plant. It was built adjacent to the former Hopper Street facility at the southwest corner of the city near the Petaluma River, about 8 miles upstream of San Pablo Bay. The new plant increased Petaluma's treatment capacity from 5.2 to 6.7 million gallons per day, and it increased the city's recycling capability by adding tertiary treatment units. The main part of the treatment plant is in the center of the photo. Is there a... doesn't have it. There it is, right there. It provides secondary treatment through solids removal, activated sludge, and secondary clarification. Above the main facility is 162 acres of oxidation ponds and... there's the oxidation ponds and 32 acres of constructed wetlands up here. The pond wetland system can be operated as a dual system for redundancy, or it can be used for additional biological treatment after secondary treatment at the main facility. To the right of the main facility is 31 acres of publicly accessible... I keep losing the arrow. There it is. Of publicly accessible wetlands used to polish the water after it has been treated. Below the main facility is the tertiary treatment. God, I keep losing the arrow. There it is. Is the tertiary treatment facility. At the top of the photo shows the Petaluma River, where discharge is permitted only during winter. One of the main features of the new facility is the racetrack-style activated sludge units. These units perform well and are likely the biggest factor responsible for the increased performance that I will discuss in a moment. I think the most exciting aspect of this project is its use of wetlands. Not only do they treat and polish the city's wastewater, but they also provide invaluable habitat for wildlife. Wetlands naturally treat water by slowing down runoff. The vegetation that grows in the shallow water and the beneficial bacteria that grows on it removes nutrients and provides the basis of the food chain. The bay was once completely surrounded by wetlands, but we have lost most of them over the years through development. You, the board, have recognized this problem, and you have acted accordingly through your policies to discourage the loss of additional wetlands and to encourage the development of new ones. The city of Petaluma has also recognized their value. The polishing wetlands are now a public park that is well used and adored by the community. These photos were all taken at the wetlands, and I'd like to thank Lena Cox, who works for the city, for sending me all the photos in this presentation. Water recycling is also an important element of the facility. In 2009, Petaluma recycled about 780 million gallons per year, about half of the wastewater it treated. About 500 million gallons were used to irrigate pastures, about 190 million gallons were used for golf courses, about 1 million gallons were used for vineyards, and the rest was used on site. Petaluma recycles all of its water during the summer when it can be used for irrigation. Its permit prohibits discharges to the Petaluma River, except during the winter when agricultural demand is low. This photo was taken in September, and many of the fields would not be green if not for recycled water. In addition to the secondary treated water used for irrigation, the facility can also produce 5 million gallons per day of tertiary treated water. Tertiary treated water is of better quality than secondary treated water. It cannot be used directly for drinking. However, it can serve some of the uses currently supplied by potable water, such as flushing toilets, watering parks, and industrial uses. This leaves more of the potable water supply available for growth. The city anticipates that we'll need at least 460 million gallons per year of tertiary treated water by 2025 to offset anticipated increased need for potable water. The city doesn't currently have a storage and distribution system to deliver tertiary treated water to potential customers, but this project is an important first step in the process. The city plans to build a 2.2 million gallon storage reservoir and distribution lines to 55 parks, playing fields, schools, and golf courses, although funding for this construction has not yet been acquired. I've been on the wrong. Sorry. Okay. The best part of the facility is that it works. Biochemical oxygen demand, or BOD, is a measure of how much organic material is in the water. Total suspended solids, or TSS, is the other parameter we typically use to measure plant performance. Historical BOD levels dropped from about 19 milligrams per liter before the new plant started operating to about 2 milligrams per liter afterward. Even more dramatically, the TSS went from about 40 milligrams per liter to less than 2 milligrams per liter. There were 32 effluent violations in the 5 years prior to the new plant and none afterwards. The total cost of the plant was about $155 million, $115 million of which was for construction. Most of the project was financed by low-interest loans from the State Revolving Fund. The California Coastal Conservancy and the Sonoma County Agricultural Preservation and Open Space District also provided $2 million each in grants. The city increased sewer rates by 13% over the last 4 years to help cover operational costs, but it just completed a utility rate study and actually reduced the rate increase from the previously adopted 13% to 9%. The tentative permit we recommend you adopt is different than the previous permit because it's based on the performance of the new facility. It has fewer effluent limitations for toxic pollutants because fewer were triggered during the reasonable potential analysis. Also, the previous permit allowed blending during large storm events, but the tentative permit now prohibits blending because it's no longer necessary at the new facility. This concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from staff?
Board member Moore? Yeah, I might just wait until the
we have a
city
comment.
Representative.
Yeah, we do have people from the city here, too.
Yeah, are they going to give a talk?
Yeah, yes, we do have a card from Pamela, please.
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
The Director of Water Resources and Conservation for the City of Petaluma.
Good morning, Chairman Mueller and members of the board. I am Pamela Tuft, for the record, currently serving as Interim Director of the Department of Water Resources and Conservation for the City of Petaluma. I've been with the city since 1984. The community of Petaluma is exceptionally proud of our new state-of-the-art Ellis Creek Water Recycling Facility, and we are excited to have your staff introduce it to you today. Our new facility is a demonstration of the city's dedication to resource conservation and the establishment of a sustainable water supply for our residents and for our future generations. For example, since initiating operation of the new plant in early 2009, the city has significantly, recycled a significant portion of its treated wastewater, and plans, as Vince said, are in place to increase that amount in the future. We would also like to highlight our constructed treatment wetlands, which provide important environmental benefits and educational opportunities. Guided public tours are held each month and provide visitors a chance to learn about the plant operations itself, our wildlife, our habitats, and other benefits associated with the wetlands. We have a very active group of docents from our community who lead visitors literally by the hundreds on a weekly basis through our facilities. We'd like to thank your staff, especially Vince Christian, Bill Johnson, and Lila Tang, for all of their hard work on our permit. It's been a very involved process with many details, and we appreciate your staff's persistence, professionalism, and especially their patience in seeing the process through to its completion. We support the adoption of this permit today by the board, and we are available to answer any of your questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Board Member Moore?
Well,
I love it. Yeah.
So do we.
We don't say that very often from this board, trust me.
So I won't go on and on. Board member Moore, look out, he's going to go on and on. Actually, I had a couple of questions. I'm a true believer in this, this holistic use of wastewater as a resource incorporation in the water supply. I was curious, because I didn't know, there's a pond next to your tertiary facility, and can you explain what the function of that pond is there?
That's the flower-shaped pond at the end of the tail of the mouse. And I won't go into the story about the mouse, but it's
technical
a kind
term.
Of yeah. Technical term. That is the tertiary water supply. And because it is an open pond, we do have I'm trying to use the technical term, and I'm not going to do it, an algae bloom, which we skim off and sell to a fertilizer amenity whatever company who loves our algae bloom. We at presently use tertiary only for internal uses within the plant itself, and so that happened to be a really, really healthy bloom because of the warm weather when they took the aerials. My office looks out upon it, and most of the time it's perfectly crystal clear, but unfortunately,
I'm sorry to interrupt. So it's not a treatment. It's a storage.
It's storage.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's fine. And then finally, more of a technical question. I mean, when we talk tertiary, it gets thrown around a bit, as far as what are we really talking about. Are we talking denitrification?
No.
Are we talking... nitrification and filtration. Can you explain it?
I'm going to look back at my technical people.
Oh, yes.
If I may, Chairman.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, that's all right.
We'd like him to help us, too, with board members' questions.
Sure. Hello, my name is Monica Oakley, and I've assisted the city with this permit renewal. And the tertiary refers to the Title 22 terminology of the sand filtration rather than nutrient removal.
Mm-hmm. Monica, thanks for stepping up. Have you tracked nitrogen through the system, and are we seeing some formation of nitrogen gas in the nitrogen cycle?
We have not evaluated that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I point that out to my fellow board members and staff, who probably already know this, but the formation of nitrogen gas in wastewater treatment is the grail. It's the perfect byproduct because it's inert nitrogen gas. It's 78% of the atmosphere, and that's what natural processes do that we try to replicate in wastewater treatment, and certainly with enhancing wetlands or the use of wetlands to have natural processes. And so that's actually a documented function of polishing wetlands in particular. You don't get a complete change from the ammonia and the nitrate. The nitrate causes algae blooms. The ammonia is toxic to fish and other issues. But if we can get that to the inert endpoint, that is the grail as far as wastewater treatment. And I think you're getting some of that in this system. So I want to point out that's the ultimate treatment. And in addition to all the wonderful community and ecological benefits. So I really deeply thank City of Petaluma for having the courage and to pull this together. Thank you.
Vice Chair?
This is a very exciting new treatment plant, and I appreciate I appreciate the staff giving us the opportunity to hear about it today. I was wondering if you could tell us just briefly how it was that the community saw fit to support an increase in sewer rates. I mean, how did you generate support for that effort?
We went through a decade of analysis and alternatives. We did an incredible outreach program done in concert with Department of Water Resources and Conservation and other departments such as community development. I was planning director at the time. So we held what we called our sewer school, and well over 100 citizens went through a very extended training program and interactive discussion on our alternatives on how to treat our sewer. We also involved the entire water environment and how wastewater could be used to offset potable demand and you find more appropriate uses for it than either putting it in the river or sprinkling it on open rangelands, whether there was a higher and better use for our community. So it was a very, very long process, and the community was very much behind raising the standard, raising the bar for our community. There was, of course, people who wanted to do a cheaper plant that barely met state standards, but the overwhelming support by the community was heartwarming and very supportive of staff's recommendations. So we have what we have, and if you follow local politics, we just defeated a second ballot measure to roll back sewer rates by an overwhelming percentage. And that was the city's community and the residents and the voters stating, no, this is what we picked, and this is what we will pay for. So we're very excited about it and looking forward to expanding our recycled system and using it to the most profit and benefit to the city.
All right, thank you.
Board Member McGrath.
I'll be brief. This is sensational.
Pull your mic in a little bit, please.
This is sensational. I started my career in 1972 at EPA at the beginning of the Clean Water Grant Program. I worked in the Clean Water Grant Program with cities that I will not name in particular San Diego or Laguna Beach about how they struggled against proper treatment. But I know what a badly run treatment plant is like. I've been in them. It was working well. I mean, 19 milligrams per liter as for BOD in a secondary treatment is a well-run system, and the improvements that you have here are nothing short of sensational. You are to be congratulated.
Thank you. I will share that with our council.
Yeah, I might just caution you. We do compliment you lots of times, but then next time we put a violation against you, so be careful. Enjoy it for the moment.
Meet those limits.
That's San Francisco. We love you. Here's an award. Oh, excuse me. We got to fine you, too, along the way. So that's my history. But I'll keep it simple and practical here. Number one, did you own all the property near the plant originally, or did you have to acquire the property?
We acquired the property between the oxidation ponds and the then existing industrial park, which was at the south end of the city.
And also, Myrene, did I pick up any odor issues at all with this new amazing facility?
No.
Okay. Thank you. And then on a complimentary note, Monica, would you mind, you've been involved in this business for a long, long time. Exactly who do you represent now? What firm, if you would, please? We'll give you that privilege quickly here, because I know you were representing many people and on your own, and now you're representing City of Petaluma. With who?
Oh, with my company. Oh, yes. My new company, yes. I owned my own firm for 5 years, and I just merged it with a larger company, RMC Water and Environment, which does work very similar to what I've been doing, but they didn't have this particular niche, and so it's very complimentary, and it's worked out very well. I've been working there since the summer.
Good. Thank you for that and all the good work that you've done. So, if not, any other further comments or questions? We're all... Again, as I said, very, very impressed with the great community support. And as someone that looks at the community for increasing rates and taxes and gets beat up at public meetings, it definitely is no fun, particularly in this economic condition.
Yeah, and really, you provide an example for folks like John to say, look what's been done. You know, look what's been accomplished. And for what? Would you say 9% sewer rate increase? Did I hear that right?
Yes. Yeah.
I just had 100% sewer rate increase in my community. Okay, and I don't have a problem with it because you know I know what it costs to do this sort of thing. It really took a lot of work to do that. I know the SRF process. It's hard work, and it's just very commendable. And so that's what I was trying to say.
Thank you.
Is there a model that John and others can use to say it's possible? Thank you.
Yeah, and I mean, again, in simple terms, being selfish here, I mean, we tried November 2nd to have a 1 cent sales tax increase to save our city, and we lost. You know, what is wrong with residents? So our PD will be moving on here real soon, and we'll be contracting out services, unfortunately, like a lot of communities have to do in America. So anyway, at this time, we'll take staff's recommendation on this wonderful item at the moment.
To add in all the compliments, I think it was significant that in the elections to roll back fees, the city pointed out how even with the increased fee, they were still right in the middle of all fees in Sonoma County, that it wasn't quote-unquote excessive. And I think they did a great job of making the connection between water, wastewater treatment and the sustainability of their water supply and the benefits through the park, through the treatment wetlands and the polishing wetlands. And so I think it really is a win-win and a model we can apply elsewhere. I do recommend adoption of the tentative order. I will note that the eagle eyes of the vice chair pointed out in a couple spots where we had references to provision 6C, and that reference should be to provision 7C. And so I won't go through. After we spoke about that, I found a couple more. So there's five spots. We'll make that change in the final order from 6C to 7C. But with that, I recommend adoption of the tentative order.
I move for adoption of this water recycling plan.
I second.
Sure. It's been moved in second, and we'll have comments at this time from the vice chair.
Discussion.
Discussion.
What are the reasons I picked up on that? Well, this will become clear. Picked up on the typos. Is that I was reading the baykeeper comments, which I thought were very interesting, and they go to not this permit specifically, but to the way we structure our permits in general. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of things for the staff and the other board members about my concerns. First of all, one of the final comments that they made was that there are a certain number of constituents for which we normally have effluent limits where the reporting levels and basically the detection levels are not adequate to be able to determine directly whether we have an effluent violation. And in these cases, what we do is to try to put, if we have some other indication other than this particular, a concise measurement, some other indication that there may be a problem, we throw the element or the particular pollutant into the pollutant minimization program. Fine. But that means we need to ask a few things of the pollutant minimization program. And so I went through and I thought, well, okay, if we've got an element for or a constituent for which there's no effluent limitation, what happens in the pollutant minimization program? But if there's a quantification method that's not available, then what happens? And so I was trying to diagram this whole thing and this permit, and that's why I got confused about trying to refer to sections that weren't there. So I figured it out. And I mention this because these things are not very straightforward and easy to follow. It's really not easy to follow the way a permit goes from A to B to C. But given that, when you do figure it out, what I found was most everything that got got elevated into the pollutant minimization program, what we did from there was, the regional board, was to inaugurate a process. And again, you know, this is my theme. I just don't like processes that don't have clear points at which you say I succeeded or I failed or I need to do something else other than just reporting back once a year. So I just wanted to raise this again generically with y'all. And look for hoping that we could look for opportunities as a group and with the regulated and the environmental community in the future to come up with methods to make things like the pollutant minimization program more transparent, look for ways that we can find quantifiable measures that either get people on a stricter treadmill or off the treadmill entirely, and see if we can be a little more creative about this. I see this as in the budget analogy, I see this as trying to control a structural deficit, because all this stuff that makes us have more and more reports that we all have to read and try to analyze all these narrative reports, it just takes a lot of staff time and a lot of everyone else's time. So I'm sorry for the editorial comments here, I guess, but I did want to raise that, to thank Baykeeper for raising the issue, and hope that we can perhaps work our way through it over time. I really love this permit.
Thank you. And a lot of you don't realize that there's times the vice chair, she and her dog, are locked in a cabin in the snow in the Sierras, and so she could figure this out. And that's why I told you earlier in the day, it's great to be chair of this board with the qualifications of people like this. It's just, thank you for bringing that up. And I think Baykeepers was very wise of them to pick up on that, too. So between those comments, I think staff realizes look out, 2011, you know where this board is coming from, or a number of them are coming from. We're really looking at trying to figure out a way to keep it simple and kind of share what we're trying to do to keep this environment healthy and clean, but yet on the same time don't make it so complicated that wonderful projects like this can't really move through as easily. And it helps the engineering firms when they're dealing with it, too, trying to come up with it. So. Thank you.
Live within our means. You
know? Well, you're looking at limited resources with communities out there trying to figure out a way to do what we're requiring them to do, or the state or the feds are trying to require us to do. And I think it's taken a while, but agencies are picking up on that, I think, more and more because of the quality people that are representing you. So thank you. We have a staff recommendation to, yes, comments.
They,
name and address, please.
we do get comments from Baykeeper. We do seriously consider it. And on that particular comment, I did sit down and look at our requirements and see, was there a way we can make it clearer, more simple, whereas more clear-cut what the expectations were. And I could not come up with it, because there could be so many different scenarios when you fall into that pollution minimization trap. And one of the reasons you get into that trap a lot of times is that maybe that pollutant is there. We don't really have the analytical tools to measure it. It's just suspected. You know, if it was there, they would get into a permit violation, and that would set off a much more concrete number of steps that they have to take. And the pollutants that we're talking about, even that isn't very clear, because we're talking about these organics that show up maybe once, and then they never show up again. And then, you know, what do you do? So I really did sit down and think about how can I change this language to make it better? You know, I believe in continuous improvement, but I couldn't think of anything. But you know, we will continue to work on it. Maybe if there's a case that comes up where this happens, then we can learn from that and have language. But the problem is, no discharger has fallen into that trap at this point. So I don't know how to improve the language right now. We don't have any lessons learned from our experience.
Yes. Point and counterpoint.
I saw that, and I also appreciate the comment and the how do you look at things, where your analytical ability. And I've gone through that with what I had to figure out on as a discharger. Did I have a real problem here? Did I have bad data? And sometimes you can tell, and sometimes you can't. But for this project, what I looked at is how well oxidized the effluent is with the treatment mechanism. And I said, you know, if it's oxidizing everything that well and you're managing the sludge properly, it's okay. And that's the perspective. While I understand the concern of the very difficult to measure and tell whether that measurement is real or spurious, I don't think it's a big deal for this permit, just with this good a treatment plant.
For clarity, I don't think it's a big deal for this permit either. I'm looking more generically. And I appreciate your response. I mean, part of me says if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But the other part of me says that it's not very easy, if even possible, for people other than you and your staff and a limited number of dischargers to have the array of information across permits that would allow you to say, you know, this so rarely happens, we shouldn't worry about it, or we do have lessons learned. And it's not only for the pollutants for which we have trouble detecting. There's a lot else that goes into the permit minimization program. So I appreciate your thoughtful response, and I'll appreciate all of us continuing to try to brainstorm on this a little bit.
Thank you. Any further discussion? If not, call for a roll call on the vote motion, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. So ordered. Congratulations, and enjoy that new operation up there. And at this time, the board, I'll give you the option if you want to have a very, very brief break, or do you want to keep grinding through for San Francisco? All right, just a very quick break. I'm not going to let it get out of hand. So just a quick break for us older people.
Oh, one more item.
All right.
Reservoirs.
Oh, we got them back here.
It's a neat place to be.
Keep the water flowing here.
Yeah. There's nobody here now.
Okay. All right, we're getting everybody back in order here. Thank you, San Francisco, for your patience, and Javier, I don't believe we get to see you very often, or I don't even know if you've been before us. Welcome, and we're interested in hearing what you have to say.
Well, good morning, Chairman Mueller and board members. This is my first time in front of you. My name is Javier Fernandez, and I'm a wetland scientist with the Watershed Division. And it's my pleasure to be here to present the tentative order issuing waste discharge requirements and water quality certification for Lower Crystal Springs Dam Improvement Project. Why is this project proposed? In 1983, the Division of Safety of Dams restricted the amount of water that the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission could hold in Crystal Springs Reservoir. The reason for this were there were concerns that the dam would be overtopped and fail during the probable maximum flood event. This project seeks to restore the historical capacity of Crystal Springs Reservoir by modifying the dam in order to enable it to pass the probable maximum flood. The tentative order requires mitigation for both construction and inundation impacts, monitoring to confirm that the mitigation is successful, and implementation of a long-term management plan. The project is located about 12 miles south of San Francisco. It includes Lower Crystal Springs Reservoir and Upper Crystal Springs Reservoir in their entirety. However, construction will only occur at Lower Crystal Springs Dam and at a water quality station at the southern end of Upper Crystal Springs Reservoir. As you're looking at this map, you may have noticed that Upper Crystal Springs Reservoir is actually below Lower Crystal Springs Reservoir. The reason for this is that they were named based on elevation and not geographic orientation. The dam improvements include raising the parapet wall, enlarging both the spillway and stilling basins, and improving drainage on top of the dam. In addition, the water quality sampling station will be elevated so that it won't be flooded when water levels are raised. Construction impacts include permanent fill of San Mateo Creek as a result of enlarging the stilling basin. In addition, there will be a loss of a pond as a result of improving drainage on top of the dam. Lastly, there will be temporary impacts to creek and willow riparian habitat that will result in temporal losses in function. In addition to construction impacts, the project will also inundate wetlands and riparian habitat around the perimeter of the reservoir. The overall net effect of this inundation will be to convert wetlands and upland riparian habitat to open water. This conversion will reduce functions associated with these habitats, functions such as nutrient cycling, primary production, and pollutant filtration. There will, however, be some benefit to fish in the reservoir because raising water levels will improve connection with creeks that are used for migration and spawning. Why will wetlands and riparian habitat be converted to open water when reservoir levels are raised? The answer to this question lies in the general shape of the basin in which the reservoir lies. If the basin had even slopes like a martini glass, the wetlands would simply move up with water levels. Unfortunately, Crystal Springs Reservoir resides in a basin that has increasing slopes, like a margarita glass.
We're going to need one of those if this permit gets too technical.
I like mine on the rocks, well, salt. So as a result, there's less room for wetlands to move up when water levels are raised, and there's a net loss in wetlands around the perimeter of the reservoir. Mitigation for construction impacts includes restoring temporarily impacted areas to their previous conditions, creating pond habitat to compensate for the loss of pond from the top of the dam, creating creek and riparian habitat to compensate for the creek that's being lost as a result of enlarging the stilling basin. These creation activities will occur within the same year in order to reduce temporal losses in function. To mitigate for inundation impacts, the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission will raise water levels by no more than 1 foot per year in order to allow wetlands to move up as much as possible. In addition, for the wetlands that will not move up, they will create and enhance wetlands, creek, and riparian habitat. This creation enhancement work will occur 2 to 3 years before raising water levels. On the next few slides, I'll show you where this mitigation will take place. All the mitigation sites occur in the Crystal Springs watershed. The first three sites are north of Lower Crystal Springs Reservoir. At the Skyline Boulevard site, seasonal wetlands will be created with ponds to provide breeding habitat for red-legged frogs. At the San Andreas site, wetlands will be expanded on the edge of the reservoir. And at the upper San Mateo Creek site, shallow ponds will be created to capture water and form wetlands that will benefit the San Francisco garter snake and other species. The next four sites surround Lower and Upper Crystal Springs Reservoir. At the boat ramp site, wetlands containing the endangered fountain thistle will be expanded by removing non-native pines that are encroaching upon its habitat. At the Skyline Quarry site, invasive plants will be removed in order to enhance wetlands. And at the Adobe Gulch Grassland and Adobe Gulch Creek sites, seasonal wetlands, creeks, and riparian habitat will be restored and created to benefit both the red-legged frog and San Francisco garter snake. The Lower Crystal Springs Dam Improvement Project is also part of a much larger drinking water infrastructure program. This program is called the Water System Improvement Program and includes more than 80 projects stemming across almost the entire system from the Sierra Nevadas in the east over to San Francisco in the west. However, the majority of the projects will be in the Bay Area. The purpose of the Water System Improvement Program is to meet water supply needs through 2018 by maintaining high water quality, improving seismic reliability, and increasing delivery reliability. Important projects in our region include two dam projects, the Lower Crystal Springs Dam Project, which you're hearing about today, and the Calaveras Dam Replacement Project, which will replace a dam that is at risk of failure during large earthquakes. In addition to the dam projects, there's the Recycled Water Project, which will provide recycled water for irrigating landscape in Golden Gate Park, and the Lake Merced Water Level Restoration Project, which is part of a conjunctive use program that will store groundwater for future use during droughts. In summary, adopting the tentative order will improve public safety by reducing the risk of dam failure and increasing the reliability of water supply. In addition, mitigation will be provided for all wetland, creek, and riparian impacts associated with the project. If you have questions, we'll be happy to answer them.
I have a question.
Board Member Singh.
Before you got the order that you cannot fill the dam, existing Lower Springs Dam, you had the same capacity what you will get by improving the dam?
Yes. I'd
like to know. The capacity will come back to the original?
Yes. It'll be come back to where it was in 1983. It'll actually be a little bit less because in order to mitigate for some of the impacts, they're actually operating at a slightly lower level than they would were in 1983.
Okay. The question is, I did not read the whole document. So how many feet more water you will have after the construction? I know you will raise it 1 foot right. Every year. How many years will be raising it?
That I would have to get back to you on. I don't know the exact acre feet.
Excuse me for interrupting, but may we have our San Francisco PUC representative come forward and fill out a card later to speak, because there might be some questions and some comments, and I would imagine positive. And so,
as far as how much the volume?
You might be able to help fill in. I don't know if you have for staff. Or we got them both there. Yeah, so both of you can kind of tag team.
The elevation.
Oh, the elevation.
Hi, my name is Debbie Craven Green. I'm with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, and I manage the permitting.
How many feet?
So right now the Division of Safety of Dams has restricted us to 283.8 feet, and we'll be able to raise the water elevation up to 287.8 feet, so a 4 foot increase.
For 4 feet, is it
right?
Right. But what used to be the original level when you...
Prior to that, we were able to go up to 291.8 feet.
Right in the middle.
Right, we'll be in the middle. Exactly. The improvements that will be done to the dam will actually allow it to go up to 291.8, but as a normal operations, we won't be doing that. It's just so that in cases of extreme storm events, if we really needed to exceed the 287.8, we would have that ability to. But if we do exceed the 287.8, we'd be pulling the water down as quickly as possible. We've committed to pulling the water down within a 14-day period whenever possible.
Yeah, so you are being conservative. I know how important it is that San Francisco HHE project supplies water to the entire peninsula. You are the source line, even all the way to San Jose, how important the water supply line is.
Right.
And there is a good news. Last year, the Santa Clara Valley Water District from the state water project only received 5% of its allocation. This year, by now, they have indicated they will give 50%. Because the snowpack is higher in the Sierra. But that does not apply in your case. Well, it applies in your case, too, because you get...
Right. Hopefully we'll be having more snow melt coming down this year.
Vice Chair. But
thank you for answering my question.
Certainly.
You could just stand by there.
I don't know to whom to address this one. But the permit references a habitat reserve program. Is that... Or is that not an HCP, or is it something that PUC only runs by itself?
It's not an HCP. What it is the city of San Francisco actually had foresight to start developing mitigation before all of these projects had the impacts. So what it is they are looking for groups of mitigation sites that tie in with needs in the watershed, particularly for like red-legged frog and San Francisco garter snake. And they started identifying sites and the mitigation potential early on, and that's really the Habitat Reserve Program in the peninsula. In Snow Valley, they did the same thing, and what they did was they identified large plots of land that provided connectivity between populations. In that case, it was Alameda whipsnake and tiger salmon.
And are these on watershed lands, or have you already purchased through some kind of mitigation bank
lands? Yeah, any of the project sites included in what we call the HRP, the Habitat Reserve Program, is within watershed land, whether it's within Sunol or Peninsula. There's some projects out in San Joaquin that we weren't able to identify land, and so there's some small fraction of projects that will be going to a mitigation bank for compensation purposes.
Okay. Thank you.
Board Member Peacock?
Could you take just a couple of seconds to tell us a little more about what goes on at the boat ramp and then what the tree remediation and replacement program is, what non-native trees you're taking?
They're actually Monterey pines, which aren't native to the Crystal Springs watershed.
Right. A little over 200 of them.
Little over 200 of them will be removed.
Good.
And boat ramp is actually, that's where they have get access. That's where they get access to the reservoir for boats. So they'll use it in this project for barges, or actually it's a different project, sorry. They'll use it. It could be this one too. They'll use it to put barges on there so that some of them actually have cranes, and those will be barges with cranes on them that will move material and stuff that they need for this project.
But it's all for public employees. It's not a...
No water skiing ramp.
There's no public access.
Thank God.
Everyone would like
it. I've been angling for a fishing trip, but they won't do it.
I think the chair ought to get a boat trip out of there someday. I've lived there, maybe.
Even I haven't been on a boat trip yet.
board member, hello?
Yeah, a question to staff.
Reservoir
would have been operated to the maximum level all the time without the restriction, then there is no mitigation.
The world has changed.
Right, and I would say the real focus here on the mitigation are the functions that the wetlands and the other habitat provide, especially the endangered species habitat that's provided. There is a laundry list in the order of the many endangered species that are in this watershed that are being addressed through the program. And so we compliment the PUC by taking the large picture of looking at how can, in their own watershed, they can enhance their endangered species habitat.
Flexibility.
Yeah, so... quickly, a little softball and hardball. Hardball first. On the Skyline Quarry, which, again, lifelong resident in that area, are the explosive bunkers removed? Just for my own personal information, and I don't know if you're aware of that, but there was
a very good question. I would hope so.
Otherwise, I don't want to hurt the ears on the frogs.
If you could tell me where they are so I could avoid them, that would be great. I've been out to the site. I was never warned to stay away from particular areas.
Okay.
I could certainly check on that and get back to you, but I would assume that, I would assume that those no longer exist.
And then a little history for all of us, because we all love our history. I'm not sure the date that dam was built, but I know if anyone has an idea, and I believe Javier mentioned that possibly it was an Italian immigrant that came over to really move concrete that designed it. In the end, it spoke no English. You might want to just give us a brief history, because it's a wonderful, really piece of work in our area here.
The lead engineer for the dam was an Italian immigrant who came over and started working for the PUC as a manual laborer. So he was shoveling
probably
dirt.
In the late 1800s, you think?
Probably in the late 1800s.
Yeah, I mean, it's been there a while.
And within a year, he learned English. And once he learned English, they found out that he had an engineering degree from Italy. And he quickly moved up the ranks and ended up being the lead engineer for this dam, which happens to be on the fault line, San Andreas Fault. The lakes literally are the fault. And we're not here for seismic reasons. We're here for the maximum probable flood event. Well, normally a concrete dam would not be the type of dam you would pick to put on a fault because it's rigid and it doesn't really move. Well, this Italian engineer was ingenious in that he is probably the first prefabricated structure. He poured sections of the dam and then fit it together like a puzzle piece. So it flexes when there's earthquakes. And I'm fairly certain that it survived the 1906 earthquake, and it definitely survived the Loma Prieta earthquake. And the Division of Safety of Dams did not say anything about its seismic.
Interesting. Yeah. And if I could, with our San Francisco PUC friend, at one time, the San Francisco PUC had a wonderful brochure of the whole Hetch Hetchy project and O'Shaughnessy and all that. Could you possibly get back to staff for all board members if
sure.
they don't have one of those?
Sure, to provide
it's
those.
It's really quite an educational piece
certainly,
for us.
Certainly, yeah. It's a very interesting system.
Right, and if we could get that back to us sometime. I don't know if we even have one on hand here for us, but... Again, I from my perspective of this permit, I mean, as Dr. Singh briefly touched on the west side of the bay, without a doubt, it is the lifeblood of our systems of livelihood and life, really. And the undertaking of San Francisco PUC is absolutely remarkable and amazing, the projects they're putting together. And as I said... in history of my childhood, when it was Spring Valley Water Company, even at, before me, that the drinking marble fountains that are up in those mountains that people don't know about, but I've had the privilege to pass by, that the buggies and the horses would stop and have a drink of water is just priceless up there, just priceless. And it really is a treasure for our Bay Area and a treasure for our Bay. And we're talking sediments and loads and erosions. There's not too many days in my years that you see a lot of mud in that reservoir.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good positive step there. Again, we mentioned about the elevation and the years and the history, regulations have changed. I mean, if we were to go back home today and talk to great-grandpa about having this wetland mitigation process going about raising the elevation of this dam at the possible maximum of 4 feet, probably say, what the hell are you doing? You know, but this is what we have to do now. And
right.
So at a huge cost, mm-hmm. too, a right. huge cost, because I've seen them out there. I'm over that thing every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just very pleased that we're in the process of doing something to ensure that that structure will be there for generations to come. And to move the water properly down through San Mateo Creek, where there's thousands and thousands of residents that live along that watershed. So I'll let it go with that, but I think it definitely is a wonder of the world there. Any other comments or questions of this item? Otherwise, staff's recommendation?
With that, I'd recommend adoption of the tentative order before you that would adopt both waste discharge requirements and water quality certification for the Lower Crystal Springs Dam Improvement
so moved.
Project.
Second.
Moved and second. Any further discussion? If not, roll call vote, please, Mary.
Aye.
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 Aye. Thank you very much. And just quickly on correspondence here, I compliment the letter writers for particularly with Randy Lee on the site of the new San Mateo County Jail. And I think this is a great improvement. It's really kind of a brownfield area there, industrial area. And unfortunately, San Mateo County has to build a new jail. But I was with the sheriff last night, again, at the swearing in of the Board of Supervisors, and mentioned that this board staff has done a wonderful job to help move that project forward, which is a huge undertaking, and it'll be more tens of millions of dollars to house bad people. But we have to have it. So compliment all the letters that were sent in. So thank you for that. And legal counsel, I believe at this time, closed session?
We had a closed session anticipated. However, our Deputy Attorney General representing us in the suit is out of town for a funeral. So we'll continue that and have the closed session in February instead. It won't slow our settlement discussions.
Good. If no further items, I thank all of you. I know Vice Chair has been under the weather like everybody in the Bay Area, I think, and family. So we're off to a good start, January. And again, thank you for the opportunity to continue to serve. And we'll see each other in February. Maybe we could kind of get a summary, a little sheepherder's count of what big items we have coming before us in 2011, if that's possible.
Yeah, we can.
Just a little kind of update what we have to look forward to and make sure we connect the dots that we're all available if it's a long day ahead. You know,
I had thought of that when I looked at the status report, that it would be nice to have some strategic idea of what our plan of work for the year is, and particularly as the budget implications become clearer, what we're going to have to live without and what our priorities are going to be. Because I think having the board and the staff on the same page for priority setting is important.
Very good.
We shall do.
And so with that, I think we can adjourn, and thank you all very much.
Thank you.